Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today in the studio, I had with me Paolo Pio. Paolo is co-founder and general partner at Exceptional Ventures, a fund focused on businesses that are helping people live healthier, happier and longer lives. In today's episode, we talked about why there were 40% fewer funds launched in 22 versus 2021, why it is that Italy is seeing a resurgence in venture and the tech ecosystem, and how we're going to get people to live to 120 years and what it means for their health along the way, as well as their financial well-being. You're not going to want to miss this episode. It is a cracker. Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today in the studio with me, I am really excited to have Paolo Pio. Paolo is the co-founder and general partner at Exceptional Ventures, a fund focused on businesses that are helping people live healthier, happier and longer lives. Paolo, it's great to have you here in the studio with me.
Thank you so much, Arish, for the beautiful introduction, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Amazing. Well, let's dive straight in. So we obviously talked quite a fair amount in our primer episode about some of the verticals that you're investing in, but it'd be great to do a bit of a deeper dive. So what this thesis around healthier, happier, longer lives, what does that actually mean in reality? Because that's quite a broad church of potential businesses that fall into that into those categories.
Yeah, you're entirely right. And I guess intentionally so. We believe that there is a number of things that contribute to people living longer and healthier lives, right? And especially related with the two biggest verticals that we discussed, which are health tech and food tech, right? And so health tech, so you want to have a proactive approach to your health, right? And we believe that actually this trend is happening, and we want to ride it as well as drive it, where people take charge of their own health. And so it's not anymore about waiting until you're sick, getting yourself to a hospital and going back to base, but it's more about, I'm good, but I want to be great. I want to be the best version of myself, and I want to take responsibility for it, right? We love that, and that's really what we are building for and supporting, and this shows into mental health, right? And so tech and science that helps us deal better with our own mental health, right? And physical health, so related to everything that goes from our gut microbiome to our fertility, that goes from our optimization or understanding how food impacts our body in terms of how nutrients get absorbed and how, you know, which foods spike our glucose and all that. And there is so much within startup land in the space of health tech that is fascinating, and I believe it's going to be hugely helpful for improving health of people as through the years. But and food tech is tightly related to it, because nutrition is fundamental to the way we feel. There's no escaping, and so we spend a lot of time on it, on alternative proteins, which is the main category, I guess, within food tech. And really, we believe that the two together can help people extend lifespans for people, as well as health span within that. And if you look into more the proper literature around longevity, the idea is not only to help people live longer lives, and so we're talking about 120 years or maybe 150 years, right, with our biological bodies, but then also about within this arch also maximizing the span in which you're healthy. And so if it's 120 years, then you want to be healthy for 119 or 19 and a half, and really only the last few months of your life are those where things start decaying. And this is proven in a number of studies on centenarians and ultra centenarians, where diseases that normally would happen in people around their 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, you know, they go from dementia to Alzheimer's to cardiovascular disease and all the others. The curve is later in the life of the centenarians. So they it's not that they don't get it, but they start getting, you know, 20, 30 years later, right? So how can we make sure that is the case for everyone? How can we make sure that people have better, you know, longer health spans? So better quality of life for longer. And this is these two are the main drivers in getting there. And then the support of all this is around financial health. And so the possibility for people to actually have a financial freedom and sustain themselves through these longer lives, right? And without having to rely on the government pension. And we have an eye on that, and we are investing in that as well. So yeah, it all comes together from our perspective.
Yeah, and look, I mean, there's a few things that are worth digging into there. I think so one of the things that that crossed my mind was it's also this interaction between bits and atoms, or bits and cells, actually, I guess, in this particular instance. Right. So over the last several years, we've seen, you know, explosion of tracking apps. Right. So there's a lot of data now being gathered about, you know, you mentioned glucose levels, but there's also, you know, Oura and sleep. You've got Whoop tracking strain. You've got, you know, Apple obviously monitoring everything that's going on your body as well as Google. So that was kind of one end of the spectrum where it was just like, here's some data. Now you go off and figure out what you need to do. But now it feels like technology has moved to a place where we can build products that actually assist in making the changes to make that data better, or not to make the data better, to make your personal sort of lifestyle better. And I wonder how that transition, how you are seeing that transition. Are you seeing more businesses that are still sort of doing the tracking, or is it more now creating the products that actually make your life better? And how do you see kind of the balance between those two?
I think it is a great point. And, you know, I keep on seeing both. So we recently invested in a startup in the UK that does a new model, new type of continuous glucose monitor, yeah. Right? Which is a device used by diabetics to continuously monitor their glucose. Well, this company can do the glucose and can do it cheaper, longer lasting, because the existing CGMs are very expensive.
2 weeks, right, £150 pounds each time, really expensive. Yeah.
So they can lower the price point by an order of magnitude, and they making it reusable. But not only tracking glucose, but also tracking ketones and other biomarkers such as cortisol and others, right? And so this will allow us to have a lot of information about our bodies in a continuous manner, which is super helpful and really tells, okay, you know, maybe pasta spikes my glucose, but not yours, and you are perfectly fine eating it, and I shouldn't. But maybe, you know, fat you don't, you know, are horrible for you, and I actually do well with them. So the concept around, so it's gonna tell us a concept around personalized nutrition, and the same food affects people in different ways, and it's not that there is one diet that works for everyone. So number one is, I see more and more companies that do more and more tracking systems. And also I see companies that do, that implement, that help you implement those changes in real life, right? And allow, for example, a company we're diligencing now is fascinating, is a device that helps you meditate better, right? And I've already tried one back like 2 or 3 years ago, Muse, and it's something you put around your head, and then you start meditating, and that when you reach the right wavelength frequency, you hear a certain noise, which was like the birds chirping, mm-hmm. right? And then you know that you are doing it right in a way. And when your mind goes away, that sound changes. Mm-hmm. And so you need to bring it back here. Mm. And then you hear that sounds again. So it's a reinforcement mechanism, right, that helps you become a better meditator. And we're looking at another company that is even more advanced right now, so to improve on that practice. So I am so excited by the fact that I see so much activity in both sense, and I don't think we have stopped one or the other, but so much is happening in both.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that there are devices such as the one you mentioned, you know, out there that are now sort of measuring brain waves and frequencies, as you say, versus, let's say, you know, 5 years ago it was calm, you know, you would basically go through guided meditations, etc., which is great, but it's slightly passive. It's not actually telling you whether you are, quote unquote, doing it right. So I think that's super interesting. It's certainly something that I've struggled with when I've tried my meditation practices, actually knowing whether I am in a meditative state or not. And I guess hearing birds chirping might actually help me with that. Let's switch tack a little bit. So you spent a huge amount of time at Cisco, as we discussed in the primer episode. And, you know, towards the end, you were in product, you were in business development, you started as a software engineer, et cetera. And you talked a little bit about in the primer about how you then got into sort of investing in venture. But I'd love to understand, I guess, two things that came up also in the primer episode. So one, what was it that led you to understand that investing was what you wanted to move into? And I guess, you know, you talked a little bit about how you started your angel journey. I'd love to take a deeper dive because, you know, I'm a very small check angel investor. But, you know, the biggest difficulties are deal flow and allocation, right? How do you get into, how do you find a deal and how do you get into that deal? So I'd love to understand how you thought about that as you made that transition.
Yes. So, yes, it was Cisco for 13 years, from 2006 until 2019, early 2019. And that was from, I lived in Silicon Valley in San Francisco, and then I lived in Switzerland, and then I lived eventually in London. So across locations and across jobs and geographies. I can only say good things. You know, it was great. I learned tons, and big companies allow you to move laterally, right, and change jobs within it. And so you can see a lot if you want to. And that I definitely took advantage of that. You know, how did I know where I wanted to go, that they wanted to move into investments? I didn't. I really didn't. So the first jobs I got out of, you know, the software engineering job in 2006, it was almost by chance. Somebody came to give a presentation at my university in Turin, where I was graduating, and I went about an internship position in Cisco in Silicon Valley. So I went home, I put down my resume, and I sent it in, and then I interviewed, and I got the position, and I took it and left. But really, I wasn't really, so it was completely by chance the start of my journey, right? And then, but then from there on, it was like a continuous research of what I like. And it took me many, many, many years, because I didn't know that venture even existed back. I come from a small town in the countryside of Italy, and there is not a lot of VCs, you know, at all.
Yeah, we're definitely going to talk about that.
No, exactly. So, you know, even when I was in California, I didn't necessarily know or had interest into getting into venture. And only later, it took me many years to move laterally and figure out what's available out there and what resonates with me. And only when I did the MBA in London, which was 10 years later, did I realize that really venture was resonating with me, right? And actually took a lot of work on one side to speak with people that were in these different industries in finance, right? So hedge fund, asset management, venture capital, private equity. Venture wasn't obvious when I got in. I actually initially thought asset management. So on one side, research with other people and understanding the industries, but then also interior research. And I started meditating 12 years ago. And initially it was really difficult for me because I'm very hyper by nature. So I really struggled being seated only like 2 or 3 minutes. And then you build it up. I actually started with Headspace. And so, yeah, and then I went to retreat. And so I, you know, struggled my way into it. And now I have a 10 minutes in the morning practice, which I'm very proud of. It's only 10 minutes, but man, it I think meditation is super important to put you in touch with what your inner self and understanding your own emotions, right? And then once you understand your own emotions, you can understand if you like this better or that better or that better. And so I realized I like venture, and for the reasons we mentioned, because it's the intersection of investments, but still there is a lot of technology and innovation, and it's about building something. Not only that, but also with venture, you interact with entrepreneurs. So it's not like I also look at private equity, but private equity is much more around building models and much more around crunching numbers and data, which is fine, but it's not as engaging as speaking with entrepreneurs who are the most inspirational people out there and are building stuff, and they're great. So you know, the disadvantage, of course, is that VC pays less of all the other, you know, industries we mentioned, because in VCs funds are smaller. And your pay eventually is a function of your asset under management. So, but in fact, I took a pay cut of 50% when I left Cisco to go into venture, right, working for the American fund we mentioned, Joint Partner. And then I took a much bigger pay cut when I decided to do my own fund.
Of course, yeah.
And, you know, you do that. I do it because I'm so passionate. I really love it. And I know that I'm going to be doing it like this, which means basically not making a lot of money for a number of years. And then eventually, if you do it right and your investments are good, eventually you're going to go back to ideally even, and then probably you have the opportunity to do really well. But it's a very long-term game.
And I think that's probably counterintuitive to a lot of people who just assume that VCs not only are sitting on a lot of cash, but also have a lot of cash personally. And I think, you know, some of the best VCs that I know, even some who've seen some significant exits, you know, aren't necessarily sitting on a huge amount of liquidity, right? Because those funds either go back into their fund, or they may have distributed to their LPs or whatever it might be. And therefore, you know, they don't necessarily sit on that liquidity. And so thinking about kind of then your entry point, like where you started doing the angel investments, how did you sort of source deals? How did you find allocation? Like, it sounds like you wouldn't necessarily have had, you know, tens, hundreds of thousands to deploy. So I'm assuming you were a relatively small check investor. How did you find those deals and get the allocations in? What's the best way for someone, you know, who's looking at moving into kind of angel investing?
Well, it was a lot of hassle. It was a lot of going to all the entrepreneurship events that London has to offer. But London is a great place to do that. Mm. It really is. Like, within Europe, I think that's why I came here right after Switzerland, because I think if there was one place that enables this kind of transition, which is not an easy transition, would be a place like London, you know, the place where things happen the most in Europe. So you know, every again, night of the week, Monday through Friday, really, I was at events that were around entrepreneurship and were around innovation. And I looked at a number of different industries, including AIs. And I was part of Tech Italia. I was very active back in those years. And so, and little by little, you start meeting people that are in the entrepreneurial background, industry field. And then in the tech, and then eventually I started meeting some startups that were raising, and I started talking with some of them and understanding what they were doing. And it took a lot of work from my side, because eventually when I started thinking, all right, I'm gonna do a check, I spent an immense amount of hours on that, because as an angel you don't have to cut a check. And so I would do, you know, months of due diligence even for a small checks, and then poor entrepreneurs that were speaking with me, and I was, you know, bombarding them with questions. And then eventually I developed conviction and cut my first, and then the second and the third. And I thought I was going to build my angel portfolio and build up, you know, 25 checks or so kind of portfolio. Then eventually I only did like three before getting a chance to speak with this American fund, which I then joined through the introduction of one of the CEOs I invested into. So that work, that exercise of network building and putting your money where your mouth is, and do. Another thing I did was I put together like a small investment committee with friends of mine that were more experienced than me. And so we would meet once a month or once a quarter, depending. And I would bring to this committee companies that I saw and I did due diligence in, and together we would decide if investing or not. And there were some friends here from the UK as well as some friends from the US, so that now also have a fund. So that helped. It, all the work you do helps. You just don't know which bit of the work is going to help, but you need to do it all.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, I guess today, like your investment committee that you mentioned there, that's probably been replaced a little bit by multiple WhatsApp groups. You know, I'm on several with a number of angel investors. And what's incredible is actually that, you know, you talked about that hustle of having to go out to all the entrepreneurship events, etc. And now Dealflow has become slightly more accessible. You know, you have products like, I don't know, Vauban, Odin, you have AngelList in the US where, you know, there is access now to more deals and smaller checks, right? So you can syndicate and, you know, as I do, write very small checks, like, you know, £1,000 or whatever it might be. But I think the thing that doesn't change ever is that point around conviction, right? So if you are looking to make that first angel investment or any angel investment, right, it's about having conviction in the business, having conviction in realistically the future of the business, because as an angel, you're coming in at the earliest stages, right? So it's being able to believe that, yes, the founder is the right founder in the right place, doing the right thing, and that this business has the opportunity to grow to an outsized outcome. But I think the point around hustle still doesn't change. Like, you have to be in the market doing things. And I think venture and tech is a massively relationship driven industry, whether it's investing, whether it's, you know, as a founder looking for your team, whether it's you know, finding advisors, angels, et cetera. So yeah, and I think that's super useful. And actually, you mentioned there about Tech Italia, and you are still like an event organizer. I think you still have sort of interaction with Tech Italia. It might come as a surprise to some of my listeners, but I have a lot of affection for Italy with my wife being from Tuscany. But Italy, to put it bluntly, as you even said, you know, it's been a bit of a basket case for certainly venture. Like in 2021, it was almost 8 years behind where France was as an ecosystem, a few years behind Spain in terms of venture funding. And you know, this is according to reports by Dealroom. But in 2022, it finally sort of reached about, you know, $1.7 billion in funding. And I think, you know, a total kind of market cap of $33 billion in terms of enterprise value. And it's anticipated to be growing at pretty remarkable rates, sort of 64% growth versus declines in other regions. So I'd love, from your perspective, both as an Italian as well as a venture investor, what has held it back in the past? And what do you think is driving it forwards now?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm very pleased that you have this love and affection for my country. It's amazing. Thank you. Yeah, Italy has been changing a lot from this perspective, and I'm very happy about it. And you're right. For the longest many years, we were at the bottom of the investment deployed on the country. So why is that? Historically, I think that we have fantastic mind, you know, in terms of like academia, really, you know, smart people that go anywhere, everywhere. And we have our industries of strength tend to be more around food, fashion, design, in some cases also car manufacturing and football. Right. So, you know, if there is a lot of money in family offices in Italy across all these industries, right, football included. And so lots of people have been successful in that. Not so much in tech and entrepreneurships. And that dictates, that drives, that creates the ecosystem, right? The exit entrepreneurs that go and become angels and help other people. Exactly. So we were behind and still are, but we're catching up and we're catching up. I see the change. The change has been driven, you know, partly a lot strongly by the government, which is deploying heavily with Cassa Depositi e Prestiti, which is like the Italian investment bank, and that allocated a large amount of funds in the billions, as you mentioned, every year to startups as well as to funds. So that's been super helpful.
So that's like the equivalent of the British Business Bank or the EIF, I guess, in Europe.
That's super helpful. And then I also see that I think Italian entrepreneurs are also getting more international. Like it's a big problem if you don't speak English to win at an international level. And Italians were not the best at speaking English, unfortunately. I remember when I left and I went to San Francisco, it was horrible. The first year was horrible. I mean, still now I struggle my way through it. So, but I think like the younger generation is speaking better and better English thanks to YouTube. My niece, she's 16. She speaks fantastic English. She really does. And she learned on YouTube, right? And watching videos. So language is a big deal, and they're getting better at it. The government is helping out, and also I think there is a new wave also of VCs, right? Italian VCs are, for example, in London there is a group of Italians in VC, which is counts I think 150 people or almost 200.
I met
people.
A bunch of them, and they were Italian VCs, but were VCs in Sony. It was a really bizarre thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So there is 150 Italians in measure. I never would have guessed, but it's a lot. And it comes from the younger generation. So it's you know, Edoardo Gentili, Michael Chiesa, they are people in their late 20s. And so the newer VCs really are forming a common front into help and helping each other, but also entrepreneurship in general. And they really are. And they are doing another program this year, which I'm part of, which is taking 500 startups from Italy and helping the best ones out with office hours for free. So, and there's people that come from, you know, Accel and the best firms and you know, Five Season, and of course we're involved as well. So it's great. I think there are multiple reasons for which the country is coming back strong, and I'm very optimistic. And we're also diligencing our first startup in Italy. So hopefully,
amazing.
We're gonna, yeah, out of 15 investments, we've done none there, and I'm really hoping that we'll make one soon.
I think that's incredible. I think, you know, I've always thought about it from this perspective. It's been a shame because, I mean, Italy was the birthplace of private equity, essentially. It's where finance grew as an industry. To your point, there is a huge amount of capital from family offices, certainly in the north, a little bit in the south as well. But one of the things that I think, you know, personally, I think potentially has held it back a little bit is some of the slightly more draconian, or not draconian from the employee's perspective, but the employment laws. It's harder to hire and fire essentially people, which obviously within a startup ecosystem is essential, right? Being able to move capital and move people very, very quickly. So when you have those two things, where you have a lack of capital going into early stage ventures, and then a lack of an ability to sort of move quickly with people, especially, it doesn't breed the best sort of environment for startups. Right?
And there's not tons of appetite for risk as well.
Exactly.
So in terms of investments, people tend to be way more conservative and like more bound to brick and mortar and yeah, more bonds. So yeah, that's true. But yeah. I see the hope of change.
Yeah. Well, no, look, for sure. I think I remember recently Founders Factory has just opened up an accelerator in Milan, I think, or is in the process of doing so. And I'm hearing more and more good news. In fact, I mean, I'll be there over the summer. I'd love to speak to some of the people you're speaking to out there and understand more about the ecosystem. Well, look, just as we kind of round off, Paolo, it's been amazing sort of understanding your journey and all these various sort of factors that have influenced you. The podcast is called Nothing Ventured for a reason. I'm very bullish about people backing themselves and taking that first step. So what advice would you give to emerging managers or fund managers that are launching today? You know, you launched in 2022, you raised or did your first close certainly in 2022, one of the most difficult times in the last decade, certainly for both ventures raising from venture capital, but also VCs raising from LPs. So what advice would you give to someone who's looking to launch a fund today?
Yeah, you're entirely right. This has been the toughest of the last 15 years in terms of period of raising a fund. And I was just looking at the stats this morning, and the US counted 40% less fund launched in 2022 versus 2021. It halved, right? The number of new funds from year to year. So yes, it is a tough period. Well, I strongly believe that, hard work always pays. And I myself put in tons of hours a week. And that eventually, man, if you need to be resilient, you need to never give up. You just need to go and do it and push and believe it's gonna happen. And I think eventually you manage, maybe not to the scale that one would want, but little by little. And if you manage to do it now, which is the toughest of periods, when things go back just to be decent, not even amazing, right? I mean, you're going to benefit from that. And in fact, investing now, so now is a difficult time to raise a fund, but it's a great time to deploy because you are able to find the great opportunities at discounted prices. Valuations are compressed, and as valuations are going to increase again, right, the returns of your fund will benefit from it. So you're going to, it's gonna, you're gonna, it's gonna be better for you when you're gonna be then raising fund too. So, yeah, my advice is just to and sorry, one last thing. I think that you also really need to be passionate about it for the reason we said about the long term game and around about the fact that you know you need to be ready to not make a lot of money for a good number of years, right? And so. Why would you do that? Because you have a huge opportunity cost. Could be working at Cisco or at Google or another company that pays you really well. So why would you do that? I mean, you do it because you really need to love what you do. And specifically, for example, I liked, in my case, this was really designed around the passions I have, which are around the health and wellness and fitness and meditation and nutrition. I really believe in it for myself, but also because I think they can be hugely helpful for others, right? And really make a difference in people's lives. So I don't mind putting in the hours, even if I'm not getting paid, because I love it and because I have a long-term vision, which is over the next 20 or 25 years, this is what I'm going to be doing for the rest of my life. And so I am fine if the payoff is going to be coming 10 years from now, it's okay, right? So that would be my...
Yeah, no, my, amazing. I mean, I think what you've just said, you know, again, resonates, and I've said it before on the podcast, one VC that I spoke to said, you know, venture should never be your first job. It should only ever be your last job, right? And it's because of exactly that reason that, you know, your returns are far in the future, you know, certainly 7, 10, potentially more years away. And to your point, you have to be passionate about it, but you also need to have built up, I think, the experience to really understand and have that deep knowledge, as you clearly do, about the verticals that you're looking at. You know, if you're a generalist VC, you need to have covered a broad range of things, and if you're a specialist VC, you need to have had the opportunity to deep dive into those various areas. Paolo, it's been absolutely amazing having you here with me today. I really appreciate your time. For our listeners, if they're trying to find you online, where's the best place to look for you? You're on LinkedIn. Are you on Twitter? Where's the best place to find
LinkedIn
you?
Would be the easiest. Paolo Pio. And it's, you know, I don't know if it's easy or difficult, but I'm sure we can put it into the show notes. Reach me there, add me there, message me there. That's the best place.
Amazing. Thank you, Paolo, so much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Arish. It's been a great pleasure, and congratulations for your podcast. I really enjoy it.
Thank you so much.